It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, Lake Superior contains 10% of the world's fresh surface water. We'll look at the Great Lakes as a resource and the future of Great Lakes restoration.
First, during his campaign, President-elect Donald Trump said that he supported, quote, extreme vetting of Muslims who enter the United States.
Earlier this week, an advisor connected to Trump's transition team outlined plans to reinstate a Bush-era immigration registry that could do exactly that, vet Muslims trying to enter the United States.
That registry, called the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, was created post 9/11 and required people from certain countries to be fingerprinted and interrogated before entering the United States.
Civil rights groups criticized the plan for unfairly targeting immigrants from Muslim nations. The plan was later dropped in favor of other immigration initiatives.
Terry Givens is with us now. She's a professor of political science and a provost at Menlo College in California. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be joining you.
Well, how might a Trump-era immigration registry borrow from the post 9/11 George W. Bush era?
Well, I think it would be very similar because after 9/11, the registry that was put, there was actually initially just a requirement for immigrants from certain countries, mainly Muslim countries, to register. And then NSEERS was added as a policy in order to specifically target immigrants from particular countries as well as people currently living in the country. So I believe this would be very similar to that in the sense that it would require registration, regular check-ins, requirements for change of address, things like that.
And what was the fate of that plan that's not in effect anymore? What happened?
Well, the problem is it found basically zero terrorists. When the stated goal of the policy was to basically try to ferret out any potential extremists or terrorists, and you don't have any results from that, then the critique was, well, we haven't found anybody through this, and it's a process that can be very onerous to immigrants coming in. And there were several cases where, for example, a refugee who was not required to register was put in deportation proceedings because he hadn't registered, but then later it was recognized that he wasn't required to register, so it was very stressful for that refugee. He lost his job and so on. And so there was a huge critique out there about the effectiveness of it and if it was really necessary given other aspects of policy that were already being implemented by Homeland Security.
Do we know which particular countries were targeted in that Bush-era registry and if the same countries might be involved this time around?
Well, they haven't specified this time around, and I don't know all of the entire list of countries off the top of my head, but I know for certain countries like Saudi Arabia, certainly now the focus is on Syria. There's a variety of basically Middle Eastern countries, but basically countries that had the language being used is countries where extremism exists. So we would expect that countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria most definitely, and even Saudi Arabia potentially could be targets of this policy.
Chris Kobach from Kansas is reported to be a Trump advisor or even a possible cabinet pick, and he helped design and implement the Muslim registry after September 11th. What do we know about his possible involvement in a Trump-era policy?
Well, we know that he is definitely providing feedback to the Trump transition team. I've also seen reports that he'd been in communication with Trump advisors over the last few months, and he is seen as somebody who is potentially could be in a cabinet position, such as attorney general. Obviously, we don't have any final word on that, but it's clear that he's influencing policy and certainly has been very vocal in recent days about the possibilities of implementing this policy again, similar to what he had done in the Bush administration.
How likely do you think it is that a registry like this could be implemented, especially given that at the end of the day, even some Bush administration officials ended up being critical of it?
Given that it was one of Trump's, basically one of his campaign promises, my expectation is that it's very, very likely that it will be implemented.
Yesterday, a spokesman for a major super PAC backing Donald Trump defended the registry plan. And here's what he told Fox News' Megyn Kelly.
Perfectly honest, it is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
Not, you're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am
you know
saying
better
is
than
that
to suggest
we need to protect
America. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it, and I'm not saying I agree with it, but in this case, I absolutely believe that a regional
base... You can't be citing Japanese internment camps as precedent for anything the president-elect is going
to
do.
Look, the president needs to protect America first, and if that means having people that are not protected under our Constitution have some sort of registry so we can understand, until we can identify the true threat and where it's coming from, I support it.
That was Carl Higbee, a spokesperson for a Trump super PAC, looking back at internment camps of the Japanese Americans during World War II, saying, in effect, that there was precedent for this kind of registry. Looking forward, Megyn Kelly, obviously very critical of that. But what do you make of that kind of comparison, Terry?
Well, frankly, I'm appalled. It's really not appropriate in this context. And, you know, that was a very dark period of our history. And, you know, certainly it does not make sense in this context to be putting it into the discussion. And, you know, it's unfortunately a kind of, I think, hyperbole to connect the situation of, the security issue in a context of as if we're in war. And, the reality is terrorism is an issue and security is an issue. Yeah, I will grant that. However, we did not have any success in targeting Muslim terrorists through the NSEERS program. That is the bottom line. I do, as I said before, I do believe they'll implement it, but I'm appalled that they would even connect it to such a dark moment in our history.
We're talking with Terry Givens right now, political science professor at Menlo College in California, talking to us now about a possible return to registration and interrogation for Muslims entering the United States. And Terry, the American Civil Liberties Union has threatened to sue Trump, the Trump administration, over campaign promises like this that mm-hmm. it sees as unconstitutional. How likely is it that they could be successful in a suit like that?
Unfortunately, I've seen some comments from constitutional law professors out there saying that it's unlikely that the ACLU would prevail in declaring this policy unconstitutional. It's hard to say how a court would. And also, I believe it depends on how the policy is implemented. You know, right now we don't know the details of it. If it's exactly like NSEERS, I think there's a good chance that they might have a hard time getting it declared unconstitutional, at least according to what I'm seeing from constitutional law professors. But, if there are ways that it's being implemented that could be called out as unconstitutional, then that's still a possibility.
How do you think that a plan like this, if implemented, could affect the way the United States is seen and related to in Muslim countries and countries around the world?
I think it could be very damaging for our relationships with Muslim countries. We have a lot of the campaign rhetoric obviously has led to fear in Muslim communities, and unfortunately we're even seeing some attacks on Muslims in the U.S. since the election. And I think that from a foreign policy perspective, you know, that's something historically the U.S. has had to grapple with in terms of how we treat minorities, in this case a religious minority. It goes against our country's freedom of religion, our moral standing in the world, but just more specifically, we rely on immigrants from these countries who are actually very positive actors in our economy, and I think it could be damaging to some of our relationships in the world if we pursue this policy.
Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Terry Givens, political science professor at Menlo College in California. She was with us there talking about a possible return to a Muslim registry for people entering the United States.
Coming up, as the presidential administration prepares for a big transition, we'll look at a new report focusing on the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin expert on servant leadership who has advice on changing the way leaders think and act from the U.S. president on down.
First, as a combined natural resource, the Great Lakes contain 20% of all the fresh surface water on our planet. 10% of that comes from Lake Superior alone. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was established in 2009 under the Obama administration, the goal to address a multitude of issues and challenges facing the Great Lakes.
Northland College in Ashland recently convened a one-day summit on Madeline Island to identify accomplishments, challenges, and future priorities for the Great Lakes Initiative going forward on the eve of a transition to a new presidential administration.
Our next guest authored a report about the findings from that summit. Copies of the report were sent to the Trump and Clinton campaigns before the election. Both campaigns expressed support for the initiative.
Ron Seeley is a freelance science and environment reporter and a science lecturer in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Well, happy to be here.
So why have a summit about the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative now?
Well, I think, of course, at the time, this was the last week in September when the group convened, on Madeline Island, there's a group of environmental leaders and experts who have been deeply involved in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiatives over the last 6 years. And at that time, we were on the cusp of, the election, and there was a feeling that with a change in the air one way or another, that it was important to lay this program out for whoever the president might be and their transition teams and to give them information and important background about the restoration initiative. It's such an important environmental program here in the Great Lakes region and for states such as Wisconsin, $2.2 billion. It's a lot of money. Funding for is pending for the coming year. House approved funding just before recess for the election, and the Senate is due to take it up, or it may go to a conference committee, I believe, when they reconvene. So it was a chance to take a hard look at the program, to talk about the things that it has accomplished, which are many, and also to lay out a future and to encourage whoever is in office to continue it and build on the success that it's had over the last 7 years.
So you said it has been successful over the past 7 years. What has it accomplished so far?
Well, from really cleaning up, I think the premier thing that people have noticed the most are the cleanups of the concentrated toxic waste areas where those toxic waste have concentrated. Good example here, of course, in Wisconsin is the Fox River and the PCBs and so forth. But there are a number of these places. The Buffalo River is another one. Three of these areas, and there are dozens of them, and not a lot had been accomplished on these before the initiative came into being. And just in the last 5 years, three of them have been cleaned up to the point of being basically taken off the list. And the Buffalo example is a good one because that is a typical of these Great Lakes cities that you see that have sort of turned their back on the lakes. And for many, many years after the collapse of many of the industries along these lakes, these were sort of desolate, abandoned industrial areas. And in Buffalo, that area, with the cleanup of the lake and the riverfront, that area has now been revived. There's boardwalks and shops. I talked to a fellow from Buffalo while I was at the meeting, and he said there are kayak jams on the river now. So that's a good thing. And you see that in a number of places around the Great Lakes due to this funding.
Now, once a site is delisted or restored, does it still need special care and funding, or is it kind of mission accomplished?
Yeah, for those areas, it is. But, there's a lot of work to be done on areas yet to be cleaned up. These sediments have been there for years and years, so it takes a lot of work to get them cleaned up. But there are other projects and efforts. For instance, invasive species is a huge issue, and money has gone towards projects to, for instance, the Asian carp has gotten a lot of attention, and the approach that the initiative has taken is to actually create early warning systems that will allow us to detect these invasives before they actually get into the water basins, and for instance, with the Asian carp, there were barriers erected and other steps taken that have really prevented the spread of the carp. So everything from invasives to restoring habitat for wildlife, any number of things. Here in Wisconsin, Shawamigan Bay was a benefactor, and now it's one of the great smallmouth fisheries now. So there are a number of projects can be pointed to, and these are important because they not only clean up the environment, but they boost there are economic benefits to these cleanups, which is important considering our president-elect and the emphasis that he seems to want to place on cities and improving a lot of the cities. And these waterfronts are oftentimes in these big old industrial cities in the Great Lakes area.
Now, one of the top concerns to come out of this report is a request for funding that is given in five-year chunks instead of 1 year at a time. Why is that important?
Yeah, I think these projects, as you can tell from what I've described, are not short-term, one-year or six-month projects. They tend to stretch out over multiple years, and to undertake these is, it's a pretty complicated process that involves local governments and state governments, as well as the EPA and the feds. And so this is a very collaborative effort, which is something that makes it unique, too. But the funding, to have the funding stretched over the period of time that the project is going to last, is more assurance that the project is going to get done. I believe the bill actually that is due to go to committee, it does have a recommendation for funding over 5 years, as was recommended in the report, and it's funded. It's $300 million a year. It's not a small amount of money. So, certainly these people who convened on Madeline Island are. It was a pretty hard look at it. I mean, there was some criticism, too, that we need to rely less on the EPA and the federal agencies and more collaboration with private companies and local communities and so forth to partner in these areas. And it's also a way to get shared dollars, too, to put into these projects. But any of us who have spent a lot of time on the Great Lakes, as a lot of us have, in this part of the country, I think can understand how important it is to keep these places so that you can use them and enjoy them and really appreciate them.
Ron Seeley is with us right now. He's a science and environment writer, and he wrote a new report looking at the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative after a recent summit on Madeline Island with Northland College. And Ron, there were tribal representatives at this summit, and going forward, what kind of role might they play in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative?
That's a really important part of this, and it was one of the I think we ended up with something like 12 policy points, and the tribes really deserve their own section of this, and they're a really important part of this because of the lands that they do that are part of their sovereign nations and reservations around the lakes. There's 30 some these around the lakes, and we're most familiar probably with one of the ones that's been in the news lately, obviously, is Bad River with the Pinoki mine proposal in the last 2-3 years. And it's a good example of an area that needs special attention. It's the largest, one of the largest estuaries on Lake Superior, and just acres and acres of rice beds there. The tribes are pretty much on their own when they take care of these areas, and the proposal was that they perhaps get separate funding under the Great Lakes Initiative, so they can have full control over these dollars to spend them as they see fit on their reservations. These reservations often have control of some of the most pristine areas of the Great Lakes, nearshore areas and the lakes, and also some of the most important ecologically. So, their sovereign nature of the tribes puts them in sort of a special place where they can do things a little differently and approach protection a little differently. And so that, you know, the thought was that perhaps a separate piece of or a separate part of the pie for the tribes would be a good idea and lead to even more protection and cleanup in those areas.
And Ron, as we start to wrap up, this report that you authored, it was sent to both presidential campaign teams, not knowing at the time who was going to be president,
right,
and they
right.
both responded to it. So given that Donald Trump ultimately won the White House, what is the sense about how the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative will go over in a Republican-controlled Congress and with a Donald Trump White House?
I think like a lot of... Everybody's watching very closely, as we've all seen from watching the news. It's sort of fingers crossed here, but I think it's a more important time than ever to lay these programs out and to make the connection. I think, especially with the Trump administration, that is so focused on economy, and we've heard so much about reviving the economy and jobs and so forth. And this initiative has a tremendous economic component. In fact, there was an economic analysis done prior to its approval, and came to the conclusion that there was a projected need of about $26 billion in investments to really pull off this restoration, but that amount of investment would result in about $50 billion in long-term benefits to the national economy.
And we have to leave it there. Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Ron Seeley. He's a science and environment writer and senior lecturer in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison, joining us to talk about a new report looking at the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
Coming up after the news, our guest says we need to rethink what it means to be a leader and embrace the idea of servant leadership. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The State Department of Public Instruction has submitted its funding request for the upcoming state budget. We'll talk to Wisconsin Superintendent Tony Evers.
First, with a new presidential administration in the works, we're kicking off an occasional series on leadership. On Monday, we'll hear from the author of the book Why Presidents Fail, with some advice for the new administration on how not to fail.
Now our guest says we need to rethink what it means to be a leader, not just in politics, but throughout society. Instead of thinking of the leader as the boss, as the center of power, the top of the pyramid, he says leaders should first and foremost think of themselves as servants.
Tom Thibodeau joins us now. He's Distinguished Professor of Servant Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's been there for 30 years. He founded the nation's only master's program in servant leadership. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica, for having me.
Well, we've just been through this divisive election and post-election season. Emotions are raw for a lot of people. Do we need a change in style from political leaders and other leaders?
Well, I think that we're all seeing that there's a need for change. Robert Greenleaf in 1970, when he was the vice president of AT&T Corporation, coined the phrase servant as leader because he saw that the most effective people in AT&T at that time, the largest corporation in the world, were those people who served the people that were entrusted to their care. And I think that to reclaim that as an honorable way in which to serve, and we also know from research that it's very effective.
Talk about what servant leadership is a little more. What does it look like?
Well, servant leadership, if I'm a servant leader, I go to an organization, institution, whatever I'm committed to each and every day to serve other people, to be concerned about their growth and development as persons. What is it that I can do so that they can do their best work? for our greater good. To inspire and influence everybody each day for a greater good would be a simple definition of servant leadership, and we see that happening each and every day. And so we've been through a divisive election, and yet the government has not collapsed. Why? Because we have faithful public servants who are there today doing the work, our clerk of courts. We have our police and firefighters. We have public school teachers. We have public health nurses. All these people are public servants, continue to work for the greater good each and every day on our behalf. All of our lives are predicated in the service of other people, and that's what really leadership is.
When we think of leaders, though, a lot of times, and whether we're talking politics or business or sports, the military, you name it, we might think about people driven in part by ego, a desire to command or have power. How do you move from that to this idea of the leadership as not that, as the servant?
Well, one of the interesting things is that command and control just doesn't work anymore. You can give people titles, you can give people positions of authority, but people choose who they will follow. And generally, who do we choose to follow? We choose those people who believe are willing to serve, to serve in the best interest of ourselves, and I hope that in our democracy, the best interest of our country. And so what happens is it's an internal change. That one sees this great desire that I need to serve other people. Howard Schultz was on CBS News this morning a couple of weeks ago, and he said what the nation needs now is more servant leaders. And what they're doing at Starbucks is paying attention to ordinary people who are doing good work every day on behalf of the common good, and they're capturing these stories and putting them on YouTube to say there is another way.
We're talking to Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo University. He started a master's program there in servant leadership, and he's promoting that idea, that something we need in society to change the way we think of our leaders, not as the big boss from whom power and orders flow, but as someone who serves their staff, their organization, the people in their community. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 if you have experience with servant leadership. We would love to hear from you. Tom, on a practical level, how can we put this into practice? We go to work, whether we're, you know, the big boss at an organization or just someone who is providing leadership in some other way. What are the first things we need to do?
One of the things that's really amazing is just to pay attention. Whatever the leader pays attention to, that's what you get more of. So what happens, how do we help to pay attention in our organizations, in our communities, in our politics, is in terms of our conversations, the ways in which we talk to and with each other. We shape our organizations, we shape our institutions, we shape our lives by our conversations. Conversations come from the Latin word conversatio, which means to turn towards each other. What's the opposite of that? Aversion, to turn away from each other. And what's really significant about being a servant leader, you must have the courage to talk with people who disagree with you.
And
that's where the strength of an organization is that we come to a level of consensus by listening to each other and moving past our differences for a common good.
That seems tricky these days, especially in the political world. To the extent we communicate with people who disagree with us, it seems like we talk at or yell at them. How do we get from that to a productive conversation where we can find common ground and ways forward?
Well, one of the things, Rob, is it's interesting. If it was easy, more people would be doing it. There are no shortcuts. Everything that's difficult takes courage, sacrifice, virtue. And that's what happens in terms of a servant leader, is that over time you develop a level of virtue or strength in which you can engage in these kind of conversations for a greater good. It's a give and take. Think about in terms of Dr. Martin Luther King. He was willing with his words to proclaim a point that he never saw. And yet we have experienced a part of his dream being revealed to us today. So I think this is the nature of leadership, is the power of our language and to be conscious of how our words affect the lives of other people.
And you also, one of the other ideas of servant leadership is promoting a sense, a feeling of community. And whether that's in your coffee shop or chain of coffee shops or in your country, if you're a national leader, what are the steps toward promoting that sense of community as a servant leader?
Well, the great understanding of community is hospitality. Now, here we are talking to an audience in Wisconsin, and what's really interesting is all of us pretty much grew up with the same mother. And what did our mothers all teach us? Hospitality. All of our mothers had a little extra on the table in case somebody dropped by, and they were welcome. How is it that we create these environments where people feel welcome? And that's where community starts, creating those levels of safety and hospitality. I just traveled this weekend, met thousands of people in airports, airline, flight attendants, people working at the airlines. Everyone was so pleasant. Get up on a plane filled with strangers. Nobody pushed their way past anyone else. But why is that? Because we had a wonderful sense of hospitality, making space for the guest in our lives. That's what happens in love of the community. Who are we making space for? And then asking ourselves when we sit down at the table, who's at the table and who's not? How is it that we stand shoulder to shoulder and then broaden the circle? So this is a constant work and process, but it's noble because we see what happens when communities come together for a greater good. One of the examples that I use is how many people this last year have bought a ticket for a raffle, a benefit, because somebody had cancer, their barn burned down. And people in the room will all raise their hand. And I said, well, is it only the family who benefits from the whole community coming together? No, the whole community comes together. Benefit comes, again, to Latin words, bene facere, means to do good together. And that's what a community does. It does good together.
But do you worry, Tom? I mean, we've got a society where we're joining organizations less often than we used to. We're publicly participating less. We're not bowling together as much, as a famous book noted. More and more of our entertainment and activities are at home, isolated from everyone else. If we're communicating, it's on a computer where we don't have a human face on the other end of it. How do we get past that to bring back more of that sense of community?
Well, what's really amazing is that we're seeing it, you know, in terms of small communities in the state of Wisconsin, what's everybody doing? They're rediscovering in terms of their cultural roots and celebrations, you know, and reaching out and trying to bring people together. And so it's kind of paradoxical. We're not experiencing community and yet have a great hunger for community. We want to be part of a common good. We want to be part of a good greater than ourselves. I'll give you an example. This next Thursday on Thanksgiving, 5,000 people will come to eat at the La Crosse Center in La Crosse, no charge. It's a community Thanksgiving dinner. Last year, they were in danger of having to cancel it because they didn't have enough volunteers. It was printed in the paper. The next day, they were overwhelmed with the number of people who wanted to participate because we see this as a real good for the community, and people want to join in for the common good.
We're talking to Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's spreading the word about servant leadership and encouraging leaders at all levels, from the president-elect on down, to try and practice it.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ideas we've been hearing from our guests? Have you or your organization embraced servant leadership? Do you have questions about how to make it work for you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Tom Thibodeau, distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. And he's making the case that leaders should serve the people they work with, value their humanity, and bring them on board in decision-making.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen servant leadership in action? Do you practice it yourself? Are there lessons here for our political leaders, business leaders, and others? Do you have questions about how this works? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Tina is with us in Lake Geneva. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tina?
I just wanted to say that years ago I worked for Cracker Barrel, and the founding CEO, who has since passed on, Dan Evans, that was his mantra for the company. It was actually an inverted pyramid where the hourly employees were on top, down to himself and the CEO that took over after him at the bottom, to the point where we were even invited to home office to help institute our ideas for best practices. And that was very much how they've had this success in that they're one of the top family restaurants in the country.
Tina, I want to ask, did it feel different working in that job versus a more traditional top-down environment?
Absolutely. It was a joy to go to work. I remember even at the time that I worked there was during 9/11. It was actually 9/11 happened the day that we traveled to home office to be with them. And it was just an honor. It was enjoyable. It really was enjoyable. And it just gave you a sense of purpose at work to help others. And that was just from the management. And like I said, even from the CEO on down, you were made to feel important and valued.
Tina, thank you so much for sharing your experience there. I appreciate that. Tom, that is one of the principles of servant leadership, is that everybody at every level is supposed to get some share of the power in making decisions.
Well, what happens is that level of engagement, all of us have different levels of responsibility. All of us have different levels of compensation, but everybody's work is significant. Next week in this country, we celebrate Thanksgiving. Why are we able to celebrate Thanksgiving? Look at all the hard work that farmers do on behalf of all of us. And yet only 1.5% of the American population works on farms. And look at the tremendous amount of work that they do and how all of us benefit from their work. We look at countless people who each and every day serves us. There's a possibility of snow in the next couple of weeks in La Crosse or any part of the state of Wisconsin. I'm able to travel safely because somebody's willing to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, climb into a salt truck, make sure that the roads are cleaned and salted so that I can be safe. And you begin to recognize that all of our lives are predicated on the service of other people. And that's what happens in servant-led organizations. Starbucks is a servant-led organization. In the state of Wisconsin, you could look at People Power Electric, Festival Foods, Quick Trip Corporation, Johnsonville. All of them committed to serving the common good by serving the people who are entrusted to their care.
Tina, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Nate in Baraboo. Nate, hi.
Hi. I've been involved in leadership roles pretty much all my life. I'm an older guy now. I was leadership roles in education, principal, district administrator, all that kind of stuff. Now, the last 8 years, I've been working with a community volunteer group, and I think the biggest challenge, you have to relearn. I found I had to relearn the whole style of leadership from being more top-down to being bottom-up. And I'm just wondering if the professor has any good suggestions about where there's training programs on this. Does he do trainings, for community leadership roles around the state, what did he tell us about how to get trained to do this?
Nate, thank you so much. Tom, what help is available and maybe a bit of advice to help Nate get started?
Okay, we have our master's in servant leadership. We offer a certificate with our Chamber of Commerce teaching servant leadership. We are bringing it into the high schools. I'm working with a small rural community, bringing people together. In a community of 700 people, in the last year, we've had 70 people go through servant leadership training. And it's changed the level of conversation. Why? Everybody can be great because everybody can serve. That's what Dr. Martin Luther King said. But where it starts with is what Nate just told us. He had to step back and think about how he needed to relearn. It comes with a heightened level of awareness. I look into myself and I say, what is it that I need to do differently so that I can better serve? And it starts right in our own home. And one of the things I would say to both of you is that please don't take anything that I have said seriously until you ask my wife, how's he doing? because there becomes the proof. And so it starts with looking within, and then you begin to build on those levels of skills, of awareness and intentionality, how to hold important conversations, ethical decision-making. What do we need to do in order to build community? There are skills that one can learn to do these kinds of things. How to create rituals and celebrations that build the culture of our workplaces. These are just some of the starting points.
Nate, thanks so much for that call, and good luck. Tom, it seems like it'd be really easy to use servant leadership as a buzzword, pay lip service to it, and not really change anything fundamentally. Is that a risk?
It is. You hit it right on the head. If servant leadership is in my vocabulary, but it's not in my heart, I will do great damage.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo University about servant leadership. Jonathan is with us next in Bayview. Jonathan, hi.
Hi. I'm a mailman, so I work for the community, and I kind of really enjoyed that. I used to work for a top-up company, and I just moved out of that because I felt like there was much more I could do to help, and it's really rewarding. But my question, or my comment is more, we see a lot of news stories that sensationalize all the violence going on, like with the Black Lives Movement, usually all the violence things going on, but we never see like the 1%, the news stories that are like 1% where they show, you know, the grandma cooking a community meal or anything like that. I think our country as a whole needs to get back to that and, you know, put our volunteers and community leaders first and really show them as the stars.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. A lot of ways we could go with that, Tom, but I think one idea, and I'm interested in this from the perspective of someone in the media myself, how can we in the media focus on the people doing good work and serving their communities these ways and not, as Jonathan says, going right to the worst case?
Well, Rob, I just want to provide a little feedback and a compliment to you and Veronica. You do this each and every day. You hold a public conversation for the state of Wisconsin, and you do it thoughtfully, respectfully, graciously, and humbly. We all can learn to do this. And when we do, we turn our attention in that way, we begin to change our environment, the levels of appreciation that we can show for each person. In order to be in a healthy relationship with another human being, you need 5 comments of appreciation to every 1 of criticism. We can all learn to do this. And I think in terms of the media, we're seeing this more and more in each newscast that I watch. It always ends with a story of hope and promise and courage that gets raised up for us.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. And Tom, thank you for the kind words, humbly. We'll go back to our callers. Nikki is on the line in Madison. Nikki, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to ask or tell us about, Nikki?
I just wanted to talk about how I think that a lot of people don't understand that public servitude can be addicting, and it's a good thing that it feels that way, because once you start being a public servant, it is really, really rewarding. And I am I got that taste and then decided to pursue it myself in a program called AmeriCorps Vista, which stands for Volunteers in Service to America. And I feel like if more people got a taste of public servitude, they would be more likely to engage in more.
Nikki, thank you so much. Tom, is she right? Providing service to our community can be positively addictive?
Exactly. I'll give you an example, maybe a little bit of a shout-out to my brother Mark, who retired after 33 and a half years as a district attorney of Adams County. He was a public servant for 33 and a half years. And as a district attorney, he dealt with all the cases, all the difficulty that the rest of us really, frankly, don't want to know about. And he did it with commitment to justice. And he said this: the justice system only works if there are people in the system committed to justice. Did he serve the public good? Yes. Did he help make our system a little bit better? Yes. Because of his commitment, because of his virtue, because of his belief in the power of public service. And all of us, no matter where we are, have that ability to serve other people.
Tom, just a brief moment before we wrap up. Easy to see the divisions in society, easy to fall into cynicism. Are you optimistic that people are going to keep taking that first step to serve and get addicted to it and make a more hopeful future?
Well, I think so. I think that every time that we call upon the names of people that lift us up, what do we hear in those examples? Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, the Dalai Lama. And then when you begin to recognize that these are just ordinary people who have committed their life to goodness, you recognize this is possible. This is a democracy for which we all hold a level of responsibility. I am a steward of every institution that has served me and given me privilege, and therefore, how is it that I'm sharing this with the next generations? And I think this is an honorable way in which to live one's life.
We'll leave it there. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica, for having me.
We've been talking to Tom Thibodeau. He's a distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, where he's been for 30 years. He founded the nation's only master's program in servant leadership. Still time for you to share your stories. Have you worked in a servant leadership organization? Have you, like one of our callers, done some kind of work for the public, formally at a government level, as a volunteer, in your community, you name it? How did it make you feel? Did you get hooked on it? Are you trying to instill those values in your own kids, in the next generation? Tweet us at Central Time, WPR, if you can sum it up briefly, or share your thoughts and find some more information about servant leadership. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page.
The clock is ticking, and we have to move in the next 1,000 years or so. That's according to legendary theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, who says humans need to start working toward colonizing another planet before the millennium comes to an end.
Hawking says we might face some kind of mass extinction event in that time frame, possibly a natural disaster, possibly helped along by humans.
So he says it's time to get cracking on finding new planets to colonize and also figuring out, little things like how to get there and how to live once we get there.
Yeah, 1,000 years sounds like a long time, but we've been, at modern civilization, starting with agriculture, for 6,000 or so years now, and we're almost thinking about maybe putting a person on Mars. So maybe 1,000 years isn't that much time to overcome that challenge.
I have moved before, and I know how much planning it takes just to move from one house to another within the same city. So think about a different solar system, different planet.
All right, looking long range with Stephen Hawking here on Central Time.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive.